By practical, we must mean something that will kill us in due course. And if it's creative, if it's dynamically inspiring, then it's not practical. The practical thing to do, if you want to leave a fortune, is to leave it to an institution that already has one, so that it will continue to flourish and do the things that it is doing, but may or may not make any permanent investment in common good. Everywhere, the individual is now tempted to support trivia and not the things that are necessary in life. And where we have good-heartedness, we also often have lack of discrimination. And the generous person is simply deceived and exploited. All of these things added together make a kind of a sad picture out of the noble creature which we call man. It just does something to prove to us that in some way we're not as far from the jungle as we thought we were. That actually we will never really achieve our humanity until our heads are in the air, are way up in the sky of truth, and our feet are on the earth. Man has been given the power to think, to dream, to create, and it is necessary for him to use these powers in their higher echelon of meaning, that they are to be used to achieve the more noble and significant actions. Looking back over the world's heroes, we find that those whom we most admire who have gone before have been those who have made a great and unselfish contribution to the common good. We accept their contribution with gratitude and quietly overlook the fact that we probably crucified them while they were here. We've got to get to the point where we honor integrities, where we can recognize values, and where we are resolved to grow. Now, this growth doesn't have to be a painful thing. Most people today are afraid to think. They're afraid if they start thinking, they're going to be miserable. The truth is, if they don't think better pretty soon, they're going to be miserable anyway. So that actually, creative thought is a cure for misery, not a cause of it. The cause of misery is an individual situation in which the individual lives below the level of his own humanity, which he can't afford to do, because if he does, he'll be in trouble forever. So we've got now 2 hours a day to do a lot of things in. I think one of the things we ought to do is to gradually refine our attitude of what to do with time. We have 2 hours a day, and we have weekends, and we have occasional holidays, and we have various opportunities for doing something. So what are we going to do? Are we going on a picnic? It might be a nice idea if the whole family goes. But are we really trying to use this time to strengthen family life? Are we using it to try to improve our own abilities in a valuable way? Are we searching for an idealism? Are we looking at a great landscape and seeing in a workmanship of divinity more beautiful than anything we can create? Are we trying to find life, our place in it? Are we trying not to be cast away on the desert island of materiality? We are trying to do something to make life beautiful, not only for ourselves, but for others. Well, we have 3 general fields in which we can operate. And these are the fields of the yogas of India. The first and most apparent field is service. Service of something that is important. Service of something that we respect. Service that calls out of ourselves sympathy, understanding, charity. Something that makes life better because we have given of ourselves and not of something that we had. So service in the course of the less privileged and in the larger domain of things, a career built upon the protection of those values which we are likely to forget. Service is very important. Service is something that can really take the place of television, which is a tremendous interval. But instead of watching somebody murder somebody on TV, we can do something that is at least constructive. We can try to help someone we know is in little need of help. We can look at, become involved in community projects, which today are very numerous. We can do all kinds of forms of service and find greater help and greater happiness in working with underprivileged persons than we find listening to rock music on radio. And we can do something with life gradually to make ourselves a little bit glad about ourselves, that we are doing something that might be of some general public value. Now, the second form of growth, of unfoldment, is self-improvement. Self-improvement implies a great many things. Young people starting out today have problems of education. They are not planning an education in most parts. They are looking around or listening to somebody tell them what job will make the most money. They don't realize the fact that the job they are going to plan for, because it makes more money, may not even exist by the time they graduate. We are losing more people who were trained in something that is no longer being done than we can afford. So instead of this type of thing, there can be a discrimination, a discretion. What kind of a future can a young person make or build that is almost certain to survive? It won't be a computer, because the computers of 10 years from now, he won't be able to operate without at least 10 more years of instruction. It won't be to make a better mousetrap, because they are practically extinct. The man who made the last buggy whip was a master workman, but he starved to death. No one will follow these things. But look over the world you live in, and why do you see something that could be the basis of a good future? Well, one thing it seems to me should be given some consideration is language. Language is going to be increasingly valuable if we are ever going to build interracial and international understanding. Language, the study on the language on the side, will not interfere with your daily job as a mechanic. It won't prevent you from being a good doctor. It can't interfere with the practice of law. It can do none of these things. It is simply a trained and disciplined avocational interest to prepare for a future that is very likely to happen. They'll change the models of the cars. They'll change the model of the typewriter. They will change the laboratory techniques. But when we people want to talk to each other, they've got to have a basis of understanding. To go around as we do now, depending constantly on interpreters and translators, is foolish. We are mostly, for the most part, an isolated world limited to the English language. A world is growing up around us, in which other things are going to be tremendously important. And we cannot also depend upon the mistranslation of our ideas by undisciplined or unscrupulous politicians. So language comes in. Now, you can get a genteel knowledge of French, but this isn't going to be so useful. Languages will have to be selected for use. We are developing a tremendous polyglot population here. Language is going to be very useful. But most of all, it's going to be a problem where someone will come up and say, we've got a job that is world importance. We need a good American to fill this job, but he must speak Russian. He's not going to have much competition. Another one will say, we can put a very good man in Taiwan, but he must speak Chinese. So somebody else gets the job. And we keep on doing the things we always have done because we haven't built a future on an imagination. We haven't sensed the things that can be done that could be tremendously important. But our avocational interest also opens in language a whole world. It opens art, music, literature, history. It gives us a tremendous new atmosphere in which to work. It is an open door into a larger world. And it is much more important to us than watching somebody shoot somebody on TV. Now, that type of thing is a specialized problem in training. And as we look at it, we realize for once that it has nothing to do with the crafts and trades with which we are familiar. We are not going to be in need of more mechanics. We'll have more than we ever need. The same of doctors and lawyers. What we are needing is people who can communicate on human problems. And this is very, very short in supply at the present moment. So here is one way of planning that extra string on the bow. You don't doesn't have to be language, but it has to be or should be something which is not dependent upon somebody inventing something out of it. It is not something that we must compete with others who have more skills than we have. It is something to contribute to understandings of life. This is the second problem. It is the bridging of intervals. It is the bridging of ignorance. It is the breaking down of the barriers which lead to hypocrisy and intolerance. So these things are very important, and we can give them a lot of consideration. Another field that is, of course, tremendously vital is interreligious and interphilosophical understanding. The time has come when it is necessary for the mature, thoughtful person to understand the beliefs of the human race, what they mean, and how they can be advanced and used. And whenever a person from this country or any English-speaking country goes to a country with a different religion, he should go with a reasonable understanding of the mechanics and inspirations of that other faith. As a language will open one door, a common belief in the integrities of people will open another door. This does not mean that he has to give up his own religion. It simply is that he has to recognize his own religion in the religions of other people, and that the same principles and ideals are there. So to communicate on that matter, from a business standpoint, from a career building standpoint, can be the difference between another civil war and a better understanding between nations. These things have nothing to do with money, but they have to do with the great satisfaction of the spirit. And this is something that we are losing and don't know what to do about. Then we have other problems, and that is the Oriental philosophy of self-discipline. The self-discipline which comes from Zen, Yoga, Vedanta, or any Buddhism, or all these different religions. The individual must finally get to the condition in which he can run his own life. Instead of being in the condition of being constantly apologetic for his mistakes, he should learn to gradually live and develop his own character. Discipline will prevent him from destroying his own body, will prevent him from making himself incapable of using the faculties with which he has been naturally endowed. Discipline, therefore, is a tremendous value. It prevents almost all forms of misunderstanding. It ends gossip, jealousy, and all the small troubles that bother humanity. Discipline is to put the self under the control of a pattern. Now, this pattern doesn't have to be everybody else's pattern, but it must be a pattern which ensures that the person will never be less in his conduct than the best that he knows. This self-discipline is the beginning of broadening out the foundation of a complete life. For all these things together make up a life. A life has to be made up of a series of balanced factors. The individual who becomes unbalanced in living is going to head into disease and into sickness. And when the time of life comes when he could enjoy himself a little bit, he'll be too tired, too sick, and too weary to worry about it. So this discipline is the greatest factor in the maintaining of health. And health, in this case, is mental health, emotional health, and physical health. So a little time devoted to this problem, a little discipline every single day, a fulfillment of those things which are best as they arise, the control of temper, the control of unkindness, the end of bickerings, the ability to live with someone who disagrees with you and still live happily and harmoniously, simply because you have overstepped or gone above the basis of quarrels. If you rise high enough in quarrels, you will finally find that they end in unity. But if we nurse them on the earth, they will never get over it. So there is another point where discipline is very, very important. Now, all children growing up, and young people, and for that matter, all old people, must learn to love beauty and love life as it is. Instead of going out to criticize everything they see and do, they've got to learn the dignities of life. They've got to learn to appreciate emotionally and mentally the beauties with which this world has been naturally endowed. The sunsets, the gardens, the flowers, the trees, these things are remedies for hate, suspicion, and despair. Little by little, the natural universe, if given an opportunity, can bring great consolation to our hearts and minds. We have to gradually learn that we live in a beautiful world, and if it looks a little otherwise, it's largely because of us, that actually we live in a well-disciplined pattern. We live in a world that is almost like a great clock in which everything runs on time. We are living in a world in which laws and rules and patterns are highly protective. But we have taken the attitude that protection is a kind of imprisonment, that we are being protected from doing the things we want to do, when in reality we are protected from doing the things that we can't afford to do, but we don't realize it. Therefore, to cooperate with nature, to recognize the natural beauty of existence, to gradually cultivate the power to control all emotions that are destructive, will give us a new understanding of life. If we begin to see the beauty in things, we're not going to watch the things that are not beautiful. We're going to realize that asymmetry, discords, these things are the result of ignorance, of misunderstanding, and of excessive lack of discipline. We are going to realize that where the individual can't endure himself, can't live with himself, can't understand himself, he will make a loud noise. This doesn't solve anything, but it gets him out of his system, but only for a moment. 5 minutes later, he has to make another loud noise, and so on until he is too weak to continue the process. Actually, therefore, we have to recognize that time is a problem in health. Time means that we should do everything possible to maintain as good a body health as we can for a reasonable length of time. That we should try to be able to face life with a certain amount of conserved vitality. If we waste everything we are on riotous living, we have no vitality, we have no health. And not only is health important toward the perpetuation of life, it is important for the moods that we, in which we become involved. The individual who has lost his vitality, who is variously dissipated, run down, confused physically, and ailing most of the time, cannot have the proper internal adjustments with truth or reality. Now we have another fight in connection with this, and that is this problem of reality. The sophisticated, the skeptic, would like us to believe that there is no truth, that there are no realities, that existence is a vast, unconditioned accident, that all things just happened, and that this just happenings includes everything of biology, archaeology, astronomy, you know, everything you can think of. The universe never was an intelligent thing. It was just there. Now, to have thousands of years of culture and 20 years of education in our present embodiments and be told that nothing means anything in the first place or the last place is a little bit weak. It is a little bit an indication of stupid sophistication. It is not that way. You cannot assume, even for a moment, that this vast machinery that we see around us is without a soul. It has to have a mind. It has to have realities, and it has to have purpose. We can't imagine an eternity going on forever beyond the concepts and beyond the furthest imaginations of mortals, simply for no reason. We too cannot actually also take it for granted that anything is a cause of itself. We can't assume that nothing brought forth something, that no law gave us laws. We cannot assume that the vast pageantry of spheres, which we can contemplate at night if the fog isn't too heavy, is nothing but an accident. We are already, in science, saying it is an accident or has no meaning, at the same time depending upon it exactly and absolutely for the advancement of this science itself. If there were not rules, no scientific experiment would have any meaning whatsoever. It is because of these exactitudes that research is possible. And yet, at the same time, we cling to these exactitudes and deny their meanings. We have got to take a new attitude towards this whole problem, because it's getting nowhere. We have to realize definitely that whatever the facts may be, we must have some kind of a personal integration. We must have a philosophy of life. We must have a code which is sufficient to ourselves. And if we want to assume that we are the only creature in the universe that has such a code, what is the difference? We have to have it. We cannot afford to attempt to exist without it. For this code is the basis of the complete survival of the person. Without this code, some part of each individual is going to die. The death may not be complete. He may linger for 75 or 80 years, but some part of himself has died when he ceases to dream, ceases to hope, and ceases to have faith in the purpose for which we are created. So we have to have little thinks about this type of thing. Now, it may be that I remember a man who was in western Pennsylvania who had a farm. And this man had a little stream that ran through his farm. And the stream was a rather muggy little thing. It didn't amount to too much. And he didn't pay much attention to it. And so finally along comes one of these engineers that's hired by the community to take care of the safety of the citizens. And he made a series of researches that took about a week to find out the quality of the water in this little creek. And he finally decided that it wasn't fit to drink, that it wasn't fit to be used by cattle, that the water was not safe. So carefully he made all these researches and came to this conclusion. So he told the farmer, he said, we find now scientifically that you can't drink this water and you shouldn't give it to your cattle. You shouldn't even use it for bathing. It's that bad. And the old farmer said, well, you're probably right. My grandfather told me that 75 years ago. And the man said, how did he know? Oh, he said, it's very simple. In those very early days, there were fish in these pools. And after there's too many cesspools and so forth, the fish all died. He said he noticed that 75 years ago, and it didn't cost a nickel. This survey was very expensive and came to the same conclusion. Native intelligence can take care of many problems about which we now build great scientific projects. Because science is, instead of being organized common sense, it is a definite effort to reject common sense as being insecure, unreasonable, and unrealistic. And yet, it had not been for common sense, most of humanity would never be here. Common sense is very important, and it's really most uncommon. But actually, common sense is based upon a folk statement or concept that the common agreement, the common mind of people, is very apt to be more accurate than any specific research project. We all know because we live. And those who live in the world know more and know it sooner than those who function behind the walls of a great laboratory. Science has its place, there's no doubt about it. But science also has to realize that if it doesn't find God, that doesn't mean that God isn't there. It means that a highly specialized training has been built around a concept of a series of universal accidents, which to my thinking is the worst form of non-science that you can possibly imagine. How science can build itself upon an accident is rather difficult to understand. But they rationalize it and do a fairly good job of it. But we all need discipline in our lives. We need to say, as Muhammad is supposed to have said, that there is the 24-inch rule, the day, 24 hours, divided into three eight-hour periods, the first of which is for rest and repose, the second is for labor, and the third is for the increase of knowledge and the glory of God. We need this kind of balance now. This is the same idea that the gills had. The gills, that the life of the individual has in it no place to do nothing. It has no place to wander about in a fog. Whatever life we have is useful, must be useful to the day we die, and maybe a little longer if we really could understand all of it. But in any event, there should be no waste of time. Now, wasting time is not answer of joy. We do not have to make time a burden. Time is not a responsibility. It is an opportunity. As much time is good. There's time to have fun. There's time to be happy. There's time to serve the common good. But in all time, there must be growth. There must be something accomplished that makes us better for ourselves. If time can in the long run make us happier, then our happiness will be real. But if we depend for happiness upon dissipation, our happiness will be fatal to our survival. Little by little, we have to keep the rules if we want the rules to keep us. And these rules are that we've got to do things that mean something. That relaxation and time are for good, for happiness, for growth, for the development of potentials. And in some cases, we find people in retirement age who go into a new business and make a success of it. But if this business has something for the common good, the older person who is no longer so much concerned with wealth is likely to be a very good servant to a common need. Everywhere to work together is good. Everywhere to use spare time for pleasant labors. The Chinese, when he has a couple of spare time hours and he doesn't know just what to do with, is very apt to go out in the bamboo grove and read poetry. He might also go out in the bamboo grove and write poetry. Or he may join his neighbors in a little tea ceremony to be associated with the contemplation of the beauties of nature. We drive through the beauties of nature at a pretty fast rate, and we fly through even faster. The world of nature has disappeared for most people. The only time we really see nature now is when we have to watch somebody else's picture that they took on a vacation. That is how we travel. But there is a world that we're missing, a world that we're cutting out. Overpopulation and urbanization is resulting in the destruction of the beauties of nature and of life. And surmounting this difficulty is getting to be a great problem. We have to find new beauties that we didn't understand before. But we must have beauty or we die. So little by little, we have to find the things that help to make life possible. And if we can do that, we will have a good life, and we will make proper use of time. It is here because it is the golden opportunity. Time goes by, and in the end, the hourglass runs out. But time, while it is here, it reminds us of the saying of the old Greek sage, who on his deathbed was listening carefully to the gossip in the front room. They told him he might not be alive more than an hour, and it wasn't worthwhile to listen to gossip anymore. But he was up on his elbow with his hand curled behind his ear, and he said, "Well, I may be dead in an hour, but I'm alive now, and while I'm alive now, I can learn." And the use of knowledge and time to find out why we're here and why it is that we need to be here, and what we can do about being here, and how we can help to fulfill a plan of which we are a part and from which we can never escape. If we begin to think in these types of terms, we will have better music, better art, better literature. we will find opportunities to find the refreshments of idealism, and we will not be continuously confronted by something that destroys our faith in ourselves and other people. It's just a matter of each person becoming more or less immune to the negations which are dominant in him and around him. He must gradually build a strength of inner life, not a great, big, massive, stupendous thing, but a gentle, kindly, quiet appreciation for that which is good, and a resolution to support good where he finds it and refrain from involvement in corruption. If these things can be worked out by a simple process, the simplest person, even a child, can gradually come to understand the importance of this point of view. The child can learn why he is here before people misinform him on the subject. He can learn why he should have a nice disposition, why he should learn, why he should study. And gradually the curriculum can be made into something that he will enjoy rather than resent. I think most children would be willing to accept a form of knowledge that would help them to grow into the right kind of people, to grow into the fulfillment of those natural impulses and instincts which we all possess. We want to be happy. We would like to have a nice home. We would like to have a successful marriage. We would like to have attractive, interesting children. And we would like to help to build them into characteristics which are good for them. We have lots of things we can afford to love, but they are not the things that hurt us. And if we will gradually build back some of the simple normalcies that sophistication has tried to destroy, we will not be one of those who has to face the future as an addict of cocaine. It is all part of an escape from self, when in reality that kind of self that the individual is trying to escape is the truth in him which he is trying to deny. So if we keep these thoughts in mind, work with them a little all the time, I think in time we'll find something in time that makes it very good that we have been given this allotment of opportunity, for that is what it is. It is a time set aside to the privilege of growing up, growing into the beautiful realities which we have all dreamed about, growing and making come true the fairy tales of childhood. We can make things beautiful, but we can only do it if we gradually improve ourselves. And because of the kind of laboring world we live in, we have restricted opportunity and time to do all these beautiful things. We can do most of them, however, if we do not waste the time. That's it, folks.